This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. We know that we will be voting next year several times. In fact, who will still be running for president by the time the Michigan primary is held, what ballot proposals will make it before voters, and how we will actually be casting ballots is still to be determined. We're going to talk about that with Western Michigan University political science professor John Clark. Thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure.
So there's a couple of different proposals in the legislature right now. Republicans are proposing eliminating straight ticket voting, where you can just basically mark off Republican and Democrat, and you get all of those candidates voted for down the ticket. There's also this idea at the same time of allowing no reason absentee voting, which we haven't had in Michigan, but we have had in many other states. Let's break these down. First of all, does straight ticket voting benefit Democratic candidates, or at least does that appear to be the case?
On a certain level, that appears to be the case, and in part it has to do with what political scientists call roll-off, which is not probably a very good term, but it's our term, and so might as well take ownership of it. And the idea of roll-off is that people don't vote for all of the offices all the way to the bottom of the ballot. And there is a fairly broad consensus that voters who are more likely to vote for Democratic candidates are also voters who are more likely to roll off. And of course, that's not to say that every Democratic voter, Democratic-leaning voter does, and you know, certainly it's true of Republicans as well. But it has to do with the correlates are things like education level, like income level, so on and so forth. And to a large extent, those kinds of characteristics are also associated with partisanship. And so on that level, the expectation is that Republican candidates down on the ticket, local offices, things like that, are more likely to benefit from this kind of provision than Democrats are. And so in that sense, from the perspective of legislators as political elites, this is something of a partisan issue. On the other hand, for individual voters, both Republican and Democratic-leaning voters who intend to vote straight ticket benefit from having that provision as part of our ballot. And so
benefit because they don't necessarily have to cast a ballot in every race.
Right.
They can simply
mark it once
and they're done.
And it takes care of the whole ballot for them. And that's true of straight ticket voters from both parties. What's interesting to me is that the last time that the legislature put forward this kind of legislation.
2001. Okay.
But it was challenged, is possible for Michigan citizens to challenge laws passed by the legislature. And so there was a what's called a legislative referendum. And in 2002, voters got the chance to decide whether or not to keep that law. The law was passed by the Republican legislature, signed by the Republican governor. Voters had the opportunity to vote against it. Now, I want to circle back around to do that. Yes. This time around, that's not going to be possible, at least the way the law reads now, because they've embedded into the law an appropriation. And appropriations measures, that is, measures that involve some sort of governmental spending, are not subject to referenda. And so in order to keep this out of the hands of voters, they've inserted this provision that, you know, arguably is not really providing much of a benefit to anybody in terms of the actual money.
But it could certainly be questioned whether that follows the spirit of the law. Perhaps the letter, but the spirit of the law seems to be in question.
Exactly. But what happened with the 2001 law is that voters in Michigan soundly rejected it. It lost something like 60-40. The law was overturned, 60% to 40%. What's interesting to me is that it lost in nearly every county in the state, both in Democratic counties and Republican counties, which suggests to me that individual voters from both parties thought this was a bad idea. It was an inconvenience for them personally. And so their perspective on this, it seems to me, is very different. That's at least in part why the current legislature in this current proposal wants to keep it out of the hands of voters, because they're afraid that voters will overturn their carefully crafted plan.
No reason absentee voting would allow people to now get an absentee ballot. They don't have to give a reason, whereas in the past you had to state that either you were going to be out of town Certainly, I'm sure some people were not completely honest about that and got absentee ballots anyway, but still you are taking a barrier out of the way. And there's a general consensus, I think, amongst people like you who look at politics closely, that if turnout is up, if more people are voting, that is generally going to work in the favor of Democratic candidates. So would no reason absentee voting be something where the Democrats might be able to say, hey, this is something we can use to drive up our numbers?
Potentially so, and certainly both parties and various candidate organizations, frankly, are getting better at sort of targeting in advance potential supporters and making sure that they get a ballot in, whether that's on Election Day, which is sort of the traditional way that we thought about getting out the vote, or whether it's in advance of the election through the absentee process. There are an awful lot of states that are moving in the direction of this Michigan proposal. They aren't consistent in every state, but to allow more people to participate through some sort of early voting or absentee process. And so in some ways, you know, as a state, we're coming late to that party. But there are also concerns about voter fraud. You know, that we've got folks talking about the need for IDs, but with absentee ballots, there's less ballot security. And so there's a lot of issues that seems to me ought to be considered. But certainly it allows for organizations, campaigns, and parties to try and mobilize voters in a different way. And if it gets more people to vote, then people that are concerned about low turnout probably think that's a good idea.
I mentioned that we're going to have a few elections this year in Michigan. Of course, there's the big November election. We'll have an August primary. In March, the presidential primary will be held in Michigan. And we're seeing members of Michigan's congressional delegation now kind of pick their candidate and line up in various camps for endorsements. This week, Representative Bill Huizinga, who represents the Zeeland area, has endorsed Marco Rubio. He's the second member of the delegation to endorse Rubio, along with John Molinar, who represents Midland. Do these move the needle at all? I mean, does it mean something to a voter when his or her congressional representative says, this is my candidate for president?
Well, this is a political science-y sounding answer, but yes and no. Directly, no, it probably doesn't mean very much to most people to say, gosh, my representative is supporting this candidate, maybe I should too. On the other hand, and particularly with a very crowded field like we have right now, there's not a lot of useful information that voters can latch onto that helps them to differentiate candidates. Now, we've got sort of clusters of candidates, and so there's the what we might call the amateurs. I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but the folks who've not held elective office before, like Donald Trump and like Carly Fiorina and like Ben Carson, and so that's kind of one cluster. Then you've got the, you know, sort of the establishment candidates, and you could divide that list in various ways and so on and so forth. But within those clusters, it's oftentimes difficult for voters to say what's better about a Jeb Bush relative to a Marco Rubio relative to a John Kasich. What separates them? Because in so many instances, their policies are quite similar. I mean, there might be some differences at the edges, and there might be some differences in terms of their backgrounds and their personalities and so on and so forth. But in a policy sense, there's not a lot that is helpful to voters. What endorsements can do is provide that little bit of additional information. You know, here are members of Congress who presumably are interacting with these folks in a different way. And if a member of Congress says, yes, this is a good candidate, this is somebody that I think would make a good president, that could be potentially useful information for voters. Now, of course, Michigan voters don't need to make those decisions until March. And in March, the field is going to look a lot different than it does now. But to the extent to which elected officials are supporting particular candidates, that can help them in terms of their campaign structure, if they're going to be, you know, responsible, as Huizinga is, for helping to lead the campaign, the Rubio campaign here in Michigan. That can be helpful for them in terms of fundraising, to be able to say, look, these are the kinds of people that are supporting me, and that's why you should write a check, and so on and so forth. And so in that way, it seems to me these things are important, and candidates think they're important. They want to line up as many strong endorsements as possible, if only to say that, look at me, look at my campaign, I've got the support of these great people, and so you should think about supporting me as well.
Is it possible that a candidate who does not have any experience in elected office, such as Carly Fiorina, she has the endorsement of Congresswoman Candace Miller, maybe even someone who does not have a lot of experience, like Marco Rubio, who is still in his first term in the United States Senate, that the endorsement of someone who has been in Washington gives them a little bit of credibility with the voters that maybe they are searching for as they try to build their campaign?
Exactly. And that's the kind of signaling that an endorsement like this can mean. But there's also a calculus on the part of the endorser in terms of not only who you support, but when you make that decision. If you want to be recognized as somebody who's powerful and influential, then you want to make sure you pick a winner. And so there are at least some folks who will hold off their endorsement until the field is a little bit winnowed out and the options are a little more clear. At the same time, you don't want to be the person that looks like you're just jumping on the bandwagon. That's right. You know, once the decision is already made, at least in terms of, you know, having any sort of influence with the eventual winner. And so if there isn't a clear-cut reason to endorse one candidate relative to another, then the best strategy may be to kind of hold off. So political science researchers have suggested that if there is a candidate that has raised the most money and who's leading in the national polls and who has the most endorsements, then, you know, they're likely to win the nomination. And listeners might say, well, duh. But oftentimes it isn't clear who the winner is going to be at when the first contest began in Iowa and then later in New Hampshire. It isn't necessarily the case that it's because of endorsements and because of the money that a candidate wins. I think you could almost look at the causal arrow in reverse, that strategic endorsers and strategic campaign funders look to see who the most electable candidate is in terms of the general election, who is the most viable candidate in terms of the nomination. And so rather than their support, you know, propelling that person to victory, they're actually, on the flip side, they're sort of attaching themselves to the people that they think are going to be the eventual winners. But in any event, this stuff does matter. And again, not in a direct way, but in an indirect way, in a way of providing information to potential voters and potential campaign volunteers and supporters and so on and so forth. And to that extent, it's important for presidential candidates to try and win the support of people in all of the states. You know, just to follow up on my own comment, just real briefly, the fact that the nomination process, unlike the general election process, is a sequential process, that it happens first in Iowa and then in New Hampshire and, you know, eventually in places like Nevada, Michigan. Yeah. That dynamic in the process makes the way that campaigns operate simply different than general election campaigns when everybody votes on the same day. Now, there's some reason to think that, you know, if we had just a national primary, that would be a good thing. But at the same time, it seems to me that particularly in a field like this one, where it's very large and very crowded, the fact that it is a process that takes place over a period of time is probably beneficial to voters, even if you're relatively late in the process and you have a much smaller field from which to choose.
West Michigan Congressman Fred Upton is one of those who has not endorsed a candidate for president yet. I'm wondering, though, that if and when he does his endorsement potentially carry more weight because he's a 30-year member of the House? He's the chairman of Energy and Commerce, generally, I think, a well-respected member of Congress. Could that be of benefit to someone who is searching to not only win Michigan in the primary, but beyond that, get the Republican nomination across the board?
I would think so. And again, it depends on the exact timing and what the field looks like at that moment. It's pretty safe to say that Representative Upton is part of the Republican establishment. I don't think he would take offense at that. He might use slightly different terminology. And if there were, you know, two or three establishment candidates still in the mix from that sort of wing of the Republican Party, if you will, then the support of somebody like a Fred Upton might help to propel one of them, not necessarily to the nomination, but to at least emerge from that faction of the Republican Party. On the other hand, if there is only one establishment candidate, then, you know, the support of somebody like Fred Upton probably won't help as much, in part because of the fact that it'll be that candidate versus candidates from some other wing or wings of the party battling it out for the eventual nomination.
2014 was a pretty quiet year for ballot proposals in Michigan. Basically, it was over wolf hunting, and what the voters ultimately said didn't matter because of legislative action. And then, of course, there was court rulings that came in. But there's a number of issues now where people have at least taken out petitions. Some of those are already off the table. Fracking, the ban on fracking proposed by one group, and repealing the prevailing wage. Both of those groups said that they couldn't get the signatures that they needed. But I'm wondering if we do get a flood of ballot issues again, like, say, we did in 2012. Does that have the potential to influence other races, you know, maybe state legislative races, maybe Congress, et cetera?
It could, and in part it depends on the nature of the ballot proposal. You know, anecdotally, in the neighboring state of Ohio a few years ago, there was kind of a strategy to put a gay marriage ban on the state ballot in hopes that it would mobilize conservative Republicans, religious conservatives who maybe weren't completely enamored with the choices at the top of the ticket that the Republican Party presented in terms of their nominees. And the idea was, if we can get these folks to the polls, we know they're going to support us, but our candidates aren't going to be able to motivate them to get to the polls. And so maybe if we have this ballot issue, maybe that will be what we need to energize the base. Whether or not in a systematic way we can say, oh, yes, this is the phenomenon, this is how it works, I don't think that political science has really figured that out yet. But there certainly are folks who believe it's the case and act accordingly. Now, in presidential years, we get high turnout anyway. Voters are informed about who the candidates are, and they have at least some idea of what their positions are. That isn't necessarily true in midterm elections. And so the information that voters need to cast an informed ballot is more difficult to come by. It may also be the case that some of these folks that are pushing these issues look at the kind of turnout that occurs in presidential election years and say, wow, if we're ever going to get this issue across, we better do it now, because a smaller electorate is less likely to pass whatever it is that folks are proposing. And my guess is, at least with some of the issues that are likely to be on the ballot in Michigan, particularly marijuana, but others as well, that's really the thinking. It's not so much that the issue will mobilize voters, but rather the voters that are mobilized by the presidential race will be more likely to support the ballot proposal.
Well, looking at the issues where they have taken out the petitions and at least are starting to try to collect them, I mean, another one is paid sick leave. That would seem like something which would be more appealing to liberals and progressives. There is talk, although nothing has formally started yet, about changing the redistricting process in Michigan. Is it also possible that in this state, which has gone for presidential candidates in every 4 years now, since going back to Bill Clinton, but where Republicans have the governor's office and both houses of the legislature, that liberals and progressives are looking at the ballot as their best way to accomplish anything on the issues that they care about, that this is the mechanism that they have?
I think that's right. I mean, one of the things about the American political system is that there are many different opportunities for citizens and groups that back certain kinds of issues to try and enter into the policymaking process, whether it's through what we traditionally think of as the lawmaking process through the legislature, or through the courts, or through executive action, or in the case of these proposals, by taking ballot proposals directly to the citizenry. You know, I heard somebody say recently that they're in favor of any neutral process that serves my self-interest. And I think both in terms of the legislative proposal to prohibit the straight ticket voting option. As well as a ballot proposal, potential ballot proposal, to change the way the district lines are drawn. These are decisions that have political implications. And in the short term, they benefit one side relative to the other. In the longer term, we might see them as being, you know, relatively more neutral. But whether it's these, whether it was the proposal a number of years ago for term limits, you know, whatever the case may be, things that on their surface may be neutral and may appear to be neutral to many voters, there are winners and losers from any kinds of change that you make to the political process and to the electoral process. And so from the perspective of some of these groups, yeah, this is probably the time to do it. If not now, when? Well, you might have to wait another 4 years. And for some of these folks, 4 years, it seems like awfully long time to have to wait.
Could something like a redistricting proposal, if some group decides to collect the petition signatures, put its backing behind it, become a very expensive campaign. I think most people would expect that it would. And if it gets expensive enough, are there candidates maybe a little further down on the ballot who start saying that issue is going to be attracting some money that I could really use to win that seat?
Sure. If we remove it from its partisan context, it's not clear to me where that money for, you know, a redistricting proposal comes from, either for it or against it. And again, it's because it has, at least in the short term, you know, partisan consequences. We seem to be at a point in American politics where the money tap is virtually unlimited, and yet at the same time for individual races, that's not at all the case. Individual candidates are still trying to, you know, scrape together the resources that they need to run their campaigns. And frankly, a lot of the money that goes into those campaigns is not money that the candidates have control over in the first place. And so, you know, they may be the inadvertent beneficiaries, but at the same time, in many instances, they'd much rather have direct control over that campaign cash. What I suspect it would mean, if it were on the ballot and on the ballot in a presidential election year, I presume it will be the case that Michigan is reasonably competitive. It may mean that for folks further down the ticket, their voices are simply crowded out, that there's simply no, you know, oxygen left in the room for them to run very effective campaigns. And in a state where we have term limits, where we guarantee that we're going to have a lot of newcomers campaigning for public office by the way that we've set up our election laws in terms of the state legislature, you know, that's probably not especially healthy for democracy, for most citizens not to be able to get information about candidates. That's not to say that there aren't other ways, but many of those ways are more costly in terms of the investment of time and energy and effort on the part of potential voters to figure out what candidate choices are the choices that make most sense. Under those circumstances, what we'd expect is that they would fall back on the heuristic of party. That is, I know my partisan affiliation. I know the partisan affiliations of these candidates. It makes my choice easier. And if we remove the straight ticket option, then all of a sudden that becomes somewhat more difficult. We still have that heuristic, but the actual process of casting the ballot becomes more
time-consuming. You have to go and vote every one of those individual races. Absolutely. If you want to have a complete ballot.
Absolutely. Now, I will say, and we've talked about a little bit about election administration in the context of these legislative proposals. You know, I have to say that here in Michigan, our decision makers chose extremely wisely in the aftermath of the 2000 election as states began to look at their election machinery, what in the university setting we would call a Scantron ballot, where, you know, you fill in the bubbles and it goes into the reader, I think was an incredibly wise choice on the part of whoever it was that made that decision. And it does remove some of the difficulty of having a long ballot because you can simply just set up an additional couple of tables in your voting precinct and, you know, you don't have to worry about long lines of people waiting to use the relatively small number of machines and so on and so forth. I think that, you know, certainly is a benefit to us as voters. At the same time, we do have a ridiculously long ballot, and if there are a number of proposals at the end of it, there are an awful lot of voters who simply aren't going to get that far down the ballot.
John Clark, as always, thank you for your time.
Gordon, it's my pleasure.
John Clark is a political science professor at Western Michigan University. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.